All right. Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Mastery Teach Call with Jeannie Olowski and myself. This is Jeff Lindahl. And we are here to answer any and all of your questions. And if you want to ask questions, just press star zero. Don't be nervous. You know, we have like, just get on the queue because we're here. Because you know what usually happens is after about 10 or 15 minutes, people are like, wow, these people are really easy to talk to. I think I will ask a question. Then we get like all these questions at the end. So let's have a nice pace of questions today. So Jeannie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. And how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Nice rainy day.
Yeah, I just talked to Mary in California who told me that she finds our company spectacular because we're so easy to talk to and we give everything we can, and she liked that. So that was nice
of
her.
That was nice. Like, if you're on the call, if you can't understand Jeannie because she has a wicked Boston accent, she'll slow down and repeat herself.
Yeah, just like Jeff. Jeff's got a birthday coming up. Anyways, welcome all you new Mastery students from San Diego, California. They all had a great time out there with you. I wish I was out there because you had better weather than we did. Just a little reminder, some of you were gracious enough to get your student data forms over, but if you have not as yet, if you could please get them over to us as soon as possible so that we can get your coaches assigned and have you rocking and rolling in no time. Tammy and the crew are heading out to the multifamily training in Denver, Colorado this week. Watch that altitude. And the UP9 video testimonial contest is going on, so we need that. If you have anything, get it into us so that you can be in the running. We're going to do a high five out for Bill Glass from Akron, Ohio. He has purchased over 604 units in the last 3 years, and most of his properties are located in the Ohio area. He and he partnered on his deals with other real estate students from our eMentors crew here. We also want to do a high five to Anita Jones. She has an 11 unit under contract, and she is so excited, and I'm excited for her. Okay, so that was my little list of announcements. If anybody has any questions, you can press star zero, and the operator will queue you up and get the question to us. Have anything to add, Jeff?
Oh, I'm really excited for Anita. It's really great news.
Oh, yes, she's so excited. And she's going to, it's a seller carry back. And she is going to take his figures right out of her 401k so she can do the deal by herself. So she is like pumped.
Yeah, we have quite a few people that haven't confirmed for the immersion trainings that we have coming up. There's a couple for New York this weekend, but then we have Minnesota after that and Chicago. So waiting for those. People from San Diego, I'll send out the information for that pretty soon. But we have quite a few immersions going on this summer, East Coast, West Coast, Midwest. So if you need a schedule, just go up to the iRemember website and come join us for 3 days of intense training. Small group. Typically between 20 to 40 people. That's it. As much people that can fit on a bus. And I like small buses. So.
Yeah, not that he has to drive them.
We did the first time.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so in the interim, while we're waiting for the operator, I have a couple of questions that have been sent over, so I'll start with the first one. It says, I have a question. Some real estate firms are large. Is it good, bad, okay, or not okay to have more than one broker contact within a firm? Well, if you take in a brokerage company like Marcus and Millichap, you could have brokers that are working multiple areas. So if you're working, let's use Texas for example. So if you're using the Fort Worth, Arlington area, you would go with a broker who specializes in that area. And then if you're going into, say, Denton and Tyler and Longview and those areas, which are quite a distance away, you may use a broker that's more familiar with those areas. So I say it's fine as long as you let the broker that you're contacting know that you're also looking at other properties and other markets, and maybe they can team up on their own. So I don't think there's a problem. And by the way, that came from Stephen Brown from Maryland. Got anything to add to that one, Jeff?
Yeah. We're still waiting for Stephen Brown's student data to come in.
Oops. Opened up a can of worms there.
But it's his son that's not filling it out. So.
Oh. Okay, let's get Mr. Brown's son on the hook. Operator, do we have any questions yet?
Yes, we do. First question comes from Lean. Lean, please go ahead.
Hi, you know, this is the first time I'm calling into this session. So I have a question. I went out to look at the apartment for sale. And when I stopped by, the buildings, they all don't have for sale sign. So I started talking to the tenants there. Is it a good idea for me to tell them then that, you know, I'm trying to check the building up, for the purpose of buying the building? Do I have to disclose my intentions?
I'm a little surprised that you went over to the building when it doesn't have a for sale sign on it.
I saw it. It was posted on the internet.
Yeah, but maybe the tenants don't know because the owners of the property are trying to get all their ducks in a row before they present it to the tenants so they don't have a mass exodus on their hands. People leaving because they're not going to be there, and the tenants are suspecting they'll get a rent increase with a new owner. So, I mean, it's okay. If I was going to go check out a building that I was considering buying, I would go as if I was going to rent a unit from the place, and then I'd talk to tenants, but I wouldn't be telling them that I'd be buying or looking to buy the property, because I don't think it's a good idea.
I like your style though. I like the fact that you went out there, you started walking the property and stuff. But what you should do is you should go as if you're like an insurance broker or something, and then ask them about if there's any water leaks or anything like that. So, because usually it's like sometimes the tenants don't know it's for sale, sometimes the property manager doesn't know it's for sale. So you just always want to be cautious of that, because you don't know if it's who knows that it's for sale or not. But then if you go as an insurance broker or as an appraiser, and just start talking to the tenants, and you're being like a detective. You can find out some good information if you do it that way. And like Jeannie said, go there. If there's a property manager or at least an agent there, yeah, go in there and act as if you're going to rent it out. And say you're not sure if you want a one bedroom. You might have someone coming in for a two bedroom, so you get to go into at least two of the different style units.
Yeah, and you want to check out the property management company. Did they get a guest card on you? Did they show you a very clean apartment? Did it smell clean? Did it look clean? Were the cabinets free of any, you know, crap, mice droppings or anything like that? I mean, these are things that you want to look at. But the most important thing is you want to see how you were treated when you came there to rent. Because if you're going to use this same property management company moving forward, you want to make sure that they collected all of your information so that they could follow up with you. My sister had a genius idea that people came to her property, and she always left them with a half a gallon of one of the best-known ice creams in the area, so that people were going to go right home after they looked at her place and put that ice cream away, rather than go looking around to some other place and have the ice cream melt. So she had a pretty good method for keeping tenants. Any other questions, Ling?
Yes. Thank you for the pointer to the first one. It helps me. And my second question is, I have a listing that the seller wants to stay on to continue to manage the apartment after the sale. What is the plus and minus, and what should we be looking out for?
Well, is he going to do a seller carry back, or does he want to live on the premises? I'm not sure. If sometimes sellers want to be part of it because they don't want to face the big tax consequence that they're going to have when they get all of this money coming into their bank accounts, they're going to have to, you know, claim it, and this big tax disadvantage for them. So maybe he's looking to shelter some of those tax problems by finding a property that he can 1031 exchange his money into. Or maybe he wants to do a seller carry back on the property.
There's no mention of either. On the listing, it just says that seller owner says they can provide management to the new owner.
Yeah, I have to look at the contract that he's presenting to you first before I would ad lib on that, because if he wants to provide management, maybe he owns his own management company and he wants them to continue managing. And like I said, if they're not doing a good job when you go in to look at a place, why would you hire them as the management company?
Sure.
Yeah, you just have to find out what his motivation is to manage it. He could be like a long time owner that really likes the place, and he's like nervous about selling it. Well, he wants to sell it to a good buyer that's going to respect it the way he did. And you might not end up in a good situation where you have like someone taking over the property. He just feels like he has like maybe he doesn't have any children to turn it over to, and he still wants to be a part of it. Maybe he has a lot of pride of ownership in it. So it's different circumstances on what his motivation is. Could have a property management company, or he might just want to still there, hang out there because he's had it for such a long time. So it could be a win-win situation, or it could be like you don't want him there either. So you really have to see what his motivation is, what he's going to supply, how it's being managed right now, and why. So there's a few questions
sure.
that need to be answered. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Thanks for being brave and joining us on the call and asking the question.
Yeah, for
okay, thank you.
Up next, we have Serge. Serge, please go ahead.
Yes. good evening. Good afternoon, everybody. And my first question is it's about acquisition fee. I mean, when we have the boot camp, you know, I was excited about the acquisition fee. So my question is every single deal, okay, do we have acquisition fee in every single deal?
No. You only have acquisition fee when you're syndicating a deal. That means that you're pooling together more than two people to put up the money for the down payment and the out-of-pocket costs and the acquisition fee. But if you're doing a partnership, meaning there's two people in the deal, one's putting up all the money, the other one's doing most of the work, you're not going to get an acquisition fee. But if you're syndicating, yes, you can get an acquisition fee, and it's from 1 to 5%. I would rather give up a little bit of the acquisition fee to make the deal solid and get a better portion of ownership, then, you know, go for the 5% acquisition fee, which is like a one-trick pony. You're getting that money, yeah, it's great. You're going to, you know, have that money for a wing and a prayer. It's going to disappear before you know it. But to get something cash flowing and getting a check every single month or quarter, depending on how you're going to pay out, it's better.
Okay, question also, can you guys tell me, you know, I read it online, but I got the difference, but, you know, if you guys can elaborate on this for me, what is the difference between the, the debt partner and equity partner?
Okay, a debt partner, they get no equity in the deal whatsoever. They get an interest payment annually. They're typically in the deal for 3 to 5 years. Then they get their money back. An equity partner, they are partners. They're getting a piece of the equity. They're getting cash flow throughout the life of the property. And they're getting a piece of the equity when you go to sell. So equity partners to me are true partners. Debt partners are more like hard money lenders. And they're getting a certain interest rate, and they have no say-so whatsoever on what goes on with the property. You owe them their interest no matter what. You still have to pay them if you commit to a 10% interest rate. You're going to pay them each and every year. And if you don't have the money, I suggest you have a sugar daddy on the side that has the money, because you still have to pay them. There is no excuses. Whereas equity partners, if you don't have the 8% preferred rate of return, you can do a catch-up clause with them, but communication is key with equity partners. With debt partners, you don't even talk to them. You just send them their interest once a year, and that's it. So there's a big difference. Debt is a lot easier to acquire, but it's a lot harder to get them to come into a deal where they're not getting any equity in the deal, because, especially with our students, they're a lot smarter than most people. They know what it's like to have equity in a deal and to get that big bang at the end. And from what you buy it for to what you sell it for, you're going to get a 50% carve out there. There's a lot of money to be had with equity partners. Rather than debt, you're getting the same exact amount, and then you're getting your money back.
Okay, so I can say that the equity partner is like the investor, right? Somebody decided to put the money down.
It's a definite investor. It's a definite investor.
Okay, so are both required, if I want to make a deal, okay, I want to, you know, debt partner. That partner is like a bank, right? So that's going to have to run my credit and everything, right? So are both required credit check?
Well, a debt partner, like I say, is like a hard money lender. They're not checking your credit. They're going on the performance of the property. It's sort of like giving somebody a promissory note that you will pay them X amount of dollars. And it's binding because it's going to be recorded with an attorney. So it's a binding contract. It's a promissory note that each and every year they're going to get an interest payment on their money that they put up on the property. And then at the end of a five-year span, if that's the length of time, they're going to get their money back plus the interest for that whole year. So they're not checking your credit. They're checking the credentials of the property. You still have to go out and get a mortgage on the property, you know, because they're only putting up the down payment of 20% or 30%, whichever the bank is going to require. You still have to have a lender in place for the whole mortgage of 70%.
Also, if I understand, the debt partner is not a is not cannot be a bank, right? It could be somebody that that's willing to put that 20% down.
Yeah, bank's not going to come in as a debt partner. I mean, they're going to want you to have money in the deal. But the debt partner is your money in the deal with the bank.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, up next we have Wesley. Wesley, please go ahead.
Wesley Harris.
Am I
how
on?
Are
I am fine. How are you? Wesley Harris out here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I'm trying my best to get out of town. Anyway, the thing about it is things are so high and crazy in this area that I'm looking at where I was born and raised, Dallas, in that area, and I'm starting to build a funnel, and I'm getting a lot of submissions that I immediately don't think are what I'm looking for. And so I just wonder, should I ignore those or should I bother to take the time to phone back to the agent? Many of them are from out of state. You know, I want to do the Dallas, North Texas area. I'm getting them from North Carolina, from Illinois, from Indiana, from Florida, from Jackson, Mississippi. Do you bother to call them back and say, thank you, gentlemen, but this isn't what I'm looking for? Oh, and another thing is I get a ton of self-storage, commercial, retail, and office buildings. Many of them haven't even sent me apartments. What do you do with them? Just ignore them or say, thank you, but this is what I'm looking for?
Wesley. Let me just answer this quickly. I would never burn a bridge. So if you have brokers sending you all of these listings, you've done something right. So you've ensured with them that you have the ability to close a deal. So what I would do is reach out to the ones that send you properties in the areas that you do want to buy and let them know you appreciate it, that you're analyzing, and that you're going to be working on them, and you'll reach out to them with questions. The ones that are sending you properties in areas that you're not interested, then I would call them on the telephone and say, listen, I'm really trying to fine-tune where I purchase and the types of properties I purchase. If you have something, could you send it to me? But in the meantime, the things that you have been sending to me, I've got to put on the back burner. But don't burn any bridges because you may need them in the future.
Okay. Yes, that's very helpful. The other thing is most of these are now coming in, if they're apartments, saying price to be determined by market.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases I like that, and I'll tell you why it's coming in like that. Is because the broker made a deal with the owner. The owner's emotionally attached to the property, so they want this glorified price that is unreachable. So the broker came up with this to be determined, and they're going to wait and see what kind of offers they have coming in before they price it. So being that we have an underwriting template that is second to none, you're going to put the numbers in there with a purchase price, you know, and after you do a million of them, you're going to be able to guess around what the purchase price is going to be based on how much money is coming in. If it's around $900,000 a month coming in, you know the purchase price is going to be around 3.1 or thereabouts. If it's like $1.3 million, it's probably going to be closer to 4.5. So as you do a lot of the underwritings, you'll be able to second guess where you need to start out with. But you play around with the numbers, and when you hit the holy trinity, that's your strike price. Now you're going to drop down 10%, start your offer there, and stop at your strike price. And he may tell you, geez, you know, I'd like to do business with you, but you're way below what we thought we could get for the property, and just say, hey, if you get an offer in, can I go on as a backup offer? Don't burn the bridge. And just, you never know, it might come back to you.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I'd love to have some of these come back to me.
But you got to stay true to the Holy Trinity and don't veer away from it. Keep that always in your mind. If it's a cash on cash return of 12, a debt coverage ratio of 1.6 or higher, and a cap rate of 8 or higher, that's where your numbers need to be. So you okay. Just tell them, you know, you promised your investors that you would reach this, and you can't veer from it.
Okay,
the broker only gets paid when he sells the property.
I know. Yeah. The one of the brokers that I've been dealing with who is in Dallas, but he does specializes in secondary markets. He and I have talked a few times, and I've asked him what B and C properties, multifamilies, are trading for in some of these areas. And he tells me like 6 to 6.5 if it's a B, and 6.5 to 6.75 if it's a C. And so I feel like he's telling me that my goal of 8 is unreachable.
Okay.
Now,
so he's motivated seller.
No, he's a rich kid.
Yeah,
he's used to working with a motivated seller.
If a seller wants to price the property unreachable, move along.
Okay.
There'll be other properties.
Well, okay. I find I'm getting impatient. I want to have a deal. I hear at the beginning when you talk about that deal that the lady did. I came in halfway through that story, so I don't know her name, but the deal that she did, and I'm going, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do that now.
They are out there, Wesley, honestly.
Okay.
Jeff, you want to help with anything there?
I'm going to see Wesley on Friday, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
But I think you should be talking to them. When you talk to the brokers, you have to tell them what your investment criteria is. So you have to tell them that you're looking for B properties in B areas, or C, that you consider a C-plus property. And it all depends on what size. I would say like 40 units and above. So that then they don't send you any stuff that are in D areas. They don't send you any commercial buildings. So they know exactly what your criteria is.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind receiving the 416 unit, but I kind of got frustrated when I got the package of 7 different things, and some of them were in Louisiana, some of them in Oklahoma, and some of them in Texas.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to analyze all those, so I didn't know what to tell him.
No, you should have told him, right, on a portfolio?
Yeah.
Ask him if the properties can be broken up, okay? So then you just grab the ones that you like better in Texas and analyze those ones.
Because you know why they're giving you a portfolio of properties?
Nope,
it's I'm going to tell you why. It's because the owner of the properties has some dogs in there. And unless they sell it as a portfolio, they are never going to sell it. So they don't want to break that portfolio. They want to sell it as a group because they will never be able to sell them separately. And that's really the whole thing. And even us, we have a portfolio of 4 properties in Abilene, Texas, and one of them is a dog. But we're selling as a portfolio. We will not break it because we know that one property won't sell.
Okay.
So you're no different than we are.
All right. I'm glad to hear that. Okay. Jeff,
right,
I'll see you on Friday.
Yep, bring me
Thank
a Dunkin'
you.
Donuts coffee in the morning.
Okay.
All right, man. Looking forward to seeing you again.
So am
Bye,
I. Leslie. Thank you. Bye, Jeannie.
Okay, up next we have David. David, please go ahead.
Hey, Jeff, Jeannie.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, Jeff, I was at the immersion meeting in Baltimore a few weeks ago, in case you remember that.
Oh, yeah. What's going on?
Oh, it's all right. Just trying to get started, trying to rock and roll here with all this information.
Excellent.
So I've got a couple of questions. When you're syndicating the deal, how much information, when you're doing the underwriting, should you be sharing with your syndicating partners?
Everything.
Everything.
So when you
get the actuals from the seller and you're realizing that they probably underselling the rents, or they got some additional value add needed, and you're adding things in the template to kind of equalize what you believe versus where they are, you should be sharing that information with your syndicated partners.
Well, they can get the information anyways, so why not be truthful and above board? That's how I like to play the game. I really like to do two sets of underwriting on every single property, one with what it is right this minute and one with what I'm going to make it. And I do want to share that with our investors because I want them to be confident that I can bring this property back to the glorious property it was when it first was built. So if they see your numbers and they're all glorified right now, but the property isn't performing the way that you want it to be or you forecast it to be, why not be upfront and above board and show it to them? That's what I say. Because in that, they're going to get excited to be part of the trip. They want to be on the same journey. They're putting their money into something that they believe is going to be a better return than even you thought. So I say be up front. I don't like to hide anything.
Okay.
I think it's Boston thing. We're pretty out there.
<That's> right.
Jeff, did you want to add anything?
Okay. Do I want anything? Well, when you're looking at it, if you're sharing like your notes from your underwriting, what you're doing is you're telling them how it's performing now, and you're basically like just showing what the risk is too, that you think that the owner isn't operating in the right way, that you think this is what you can do on your projections for rent, this is why you think you can do a rent increase in this area. And if you do it that way, because you'll see like a lot of investors have been in other deals and stuff like that. So if it's one of your first deals, if you share all that information with them, then they have more confidence in going to the deal with you. And you already have it on the contract anyway, so it's not like the investors.
And the thing too is, and David, the thing about investors, they're gonna hear everything anyway. So why hold back? Tell them everything. Because they can go to the Apartment Owners Association and find out what's going on with that particular property. Maybe you've got 20 sex offenders living on the premises and you didn't even check that. Or maybe they have a neighborhood watch in place and your investors are going to know this. And if you're not sharing everything that you know, I mean, you're going to be caught up. They're not going to have faith that you're telling them everything. I say be transparent in everything.
Okay. All right. And the last question, I'm assuming you're familiar with the crowdsourcing process.
Yep.
Crowdfunding. What is your thoughts on that? You know,
I don't like it. I'm old-fashioned. I do not like it one single solitary bit because there's limitations on crowdfunding, and I can tell you, and there's probably an SEC attorney on this line anyways, but With SEC, they can be fickle. When I first started raising money for Dave Lindahl, and it was in 2007-2008 arena, I mean, you could include your primary resident as part of your net worth. While we were out in California, I collected 325 accredited investor forms, and every one of them was worth over $1 million because they could include their primary residence. 6 months later down the road, the SEC comes aboard and says, oh, from now on, you can't include your primary residence. I had to go back to all 325 people and get new accredited investors, and I only got 130 out of 325. So they become fickle, and they change their mind and change their rules. I know people are doing stupid things, like they're putting on the internet, I'll pay you 12% interest on any deal I close on. That's craziness, because people you don't even know are out there looking at it. I like the one-on-one way better. I've been very successful. In my opinion, I've been very successful. I've raised $130 million, and we took a three-year hiatus. So it only took me like 4 years to do that, and I only raise money for Dave's deals, but I do it very carefully so that everybody that comes into our deal is accredited, and they know what they're getting, when they're getting it, and we try to be transparent about everything. So okay. I don't like crowdfunding. I know Gene Trowbridge has a crowdfunding class, and he's sold on it, and he was the one that really put the scare in all of us about accredited investor forms, but he's changed his mind, but I still don't like it.
Okay. All right, thanks for that. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Okay, up next we have Anita. Anita, please go ahead.
Hey, honey bunny.
Hey, honey bunny. How are you? How are you, Jeff? Good to talk to you guys. Hear your voices.
Don't call me honey bunny.
Yes.
Oh, come on, honey bunny. Well, you're not. You know what? I only choose honey bunny for my favorite people, and you're one of my faves, but you're not a honey bunny.
Okay.
I've got it.
All right.
Nobody reaches.
Yeah, I was telling her about the girls being. I was telling her about the girls being born on your birthday, and she said your life will never be the same.
I know.
Yeah,
how
I
lucky
know.
Is that? You couldn't have planned that any better. But my husband, what Bill, was just glaring down at me when I was trying to call you honey bunny, Jeff, so I will not do that.
Oh, tell him to put his glasses back on.
Oh, Bill, I said hi.
Okay, so I got a couple of questions for you brilliant people. So, Jeannie, the deal I've been talking with you about, the guy came back and he's accepted my my negotiations, but his last thing was he says, I will accept your offer, but I want to keep the deposits / prepaid rents. I think that would work out well both for both of us from a tax point of view. How does that help us from a tax point of view if he keeps the deposits and prepaid rents? Because I will have to recreate those and create an escrow account, right?
Right, and you could do away with, you know, having people put security deposits down and just call it an application fee. So it really, in one way, is going to help you because you're not going to have to send notices around at the end of the year with their little piddly tax return. So in that respect, I think it's okay. It depends on how big the amount is. I think you said it was around $10,000.
Yeah.
Jeff, what do you think?
So, like, what's he going to do with the prepaid money that's already in there?
He's just going to take it and run. He's financing the deal for a year for me. So he's just... he just wants to, he's got these deposits. I guess he's got it in some account somehow, and he just wants to take it, and that'll be his, you know, part of his cash out of the deal.
cash out of the deal, you're going to be short those months that those prepaid hit.
If you have those people still living there, they're going to be expecting a tax return.
Their deposit,
on that.
Their deposit back.
Well, okay. You never give a deposit back because they always destroy the premises anyway. So I'm not so worried about that. I'm more worried about their income taxes. They've been used to showing, you know, a $25 or $35 interest payment every year for X amount of years, and now they don't have it. What happened to that? An accountant.
Do you think they really
might
do that? Do they do that? Do they keep track of that?
I would think so.
You're going to have to find out, because you'd have to
find out
money when they moved out.
I wasn't even thinking about prepaid rents. I don't know why. Oh, I think because he had one guy that prepaid for a year. One guy wants wanted a 5-year lease. So I guess I need to find. So basically, should I just say no, I don't want to do that, or take the increase my offer by $10,000 and keep that in place?
Well, you have to. How much of the price? Well, the first thing you need to do is how many prepaids are there? What month are they hitting? Because that's rent you're not going to get during those months. Okay.
Yeah.
So that'll
yeah,
be, that's going to affect you.
$10,000. There's only 11 units, and it's $10,000.
Yeah, because the rents are
probably
about
like $1,000.
Between $8,000 and $1,000.
Wow.
So the rent, and the deposits are 1 month rent.
Hmm.
So basically, that's a pretty big giveaway if I do that, right?
Yeah, I don't.
What?
I mean,
because
even
you have to make
though
it up.
You
what if,
made
like,
50,
yeah.
She's made $50,000 on this already because what he wanted and what we offered was considerably less, and they settled on a $50,000 reduction.
Yeah, so he's already given me back. I mean, this is basically the only thing he's asking back for. So, but I, you know, I don't want to give away anything I don't have to, but I don't want to lose the deal either.
He probably doesn't have the money. That's why. He probably didn't put it in the right account. So now he knows if he closes, he has
that's
to come up with that
money. That's what I'm thinking, too.
You know?
That's what I was
but he's,
thinking,
he, but too. He, but he fi- he's financing, so he can do whatever he wants, right? I mean, he's not. We're not going through a
yeah,
bank.
But he probably doesn't have those people's security deposits. He probably already knows it.
Oh.
Yeah. Even though he's financing it, right? If those tenants move out, you have to pay them.
You have to pay
them. Because you take over that contract
when
you buy that property.
Unless they destroyed the premises, and then it's going to cost you to fix it anyways. I would just ask him outright. I said, would you be willing to do a 50% and split it like we did the other way?
Okay. That sounds good. Okay, so thank you for that. Okay, so when I put it, so we're in the LOI process. So when I go visit the place, at what point, so I walk through the place, it looks good to me, at what point do I get a property inspection and an appraisal?
The day that you walk the property, you already
so
have
I do
the
it
LOI?
All I get everybody to-
Yeah, you don't want to fly back over there, do you?
No, I don't. Well, I mean, I do, but I don't want to pay for it.
Right.
Okay, so I just get everything set up, the walkthrough, the appraisal, and the property inspection all that day. And so then once that, I won't sign a purchase and sale agreement until all that's done. I've got all that at least that little bit of diligence done.
Why do you need an appraisal if you're not going through bank financing?
Well, because I was talking to another lender who I was originally going to go through, who's from he's a local lender, and he just said it'd be a good idea. I don't have to. I mean, what do you guys think? He said it's just because the place has been, it's an old building, and it's been completely rehabbed. So he just said it would, you know.
Well, if you know the market, right? Basically, for 11 units, they're either going to do the income or comparable method, right? So if you know the market, you know what those 11 units are going for, and you know what the cash flow is, it's like, I don't know what that appraisal is going to give you that you don't already know.
Okay, well, that's good.
To me, until you get, until you get solid financing, you know, on your own, without the lender, without the seller doing the carry back. So you have almost a year to go and get an appraisal.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's good. He would just say it. I'd do it to be cautious, but yeah. Okay. So because he says I've got appraisals like $1,500 to $2,000. Which went what?
Yeah, but I think that's a pretty cheap price that you're buying it for.
Okay.
Myself.
Okay. Well, that's great. Great advice.
But
okay,
so Anita, how did you get strong financials back from you? Because typically what you do, right, is you order the inspection, and as you're going through your financial due diligence, you'll order the inspection to be probably like 20 to 30 days out, so it gives you enough time to go through the rest of the financial due diligence. And if they start coming in, starts looking clean, everything starts looking good, then you just go ahead and have it done, to the inspection.
Have what
done? So you typically do your inspection. So you want to get it ordered. You want to get an inspection ordered, right? But give yourself at least 2 weeks or 3 weeks to go through the financials. If the financials don't look good, then you can cancel it.
Okay, because I want to go see it like next week.
Yeah. You
can
do that.
So don't worry. So it's good. So that'll make it much easier. All I got to do is worry about my own walkthrough. And the interesting thing, this is a small town, so everybody knows everybody, so it's kind of easy to find out information, which is fascinating. I mean, my lender I was talking to was at a Rotary Club meeting, and he made a point to sit by a tenant I told him about. So he was asking her about the property and how she liked it. She loved it.
Are you talking to any property management companies?
I was just going to suggest you call Kim Brueggemann. She used to work in the Raleigh area for CUSA before she went and opened up her own company with Carl Withers. Opened up Bed Rock.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have her walk it with you.
Go to
their
the property and walk it with you.
Yeah, definitely do that.
Oh, okay.
This is a relationship business. I'll give you her phone number. I'll text it to you.
Okay, perfect. Okay, and so when I do set up the escrow, does it matter where I put that? Can I just put that do I have to put that in the LLC account, or where can the escrow money go when I decide I'm going to do it?
You can
go with the attorneys.
The closing attorney.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okie doke, guys, you have been very helpful. Thank you so much.
Okay, we're rooting for you.
Oh, please do. Keep your fingers crossed.
You bet.
We will.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Thanks, Jeannie, for all your help.
You're welcome, honey.
Okay, up next we have Rhea. Rhea, please go ahead.
Hi, Jeannie and Jeff. How are you?
Hi, Rhea.
Hey, Rhea. I'm fine.
How are you?
I'm doing okay. All right. My daughter just graduated three days ago, and finally I will be by myself. So.
Jeff's daughter just graduated high school.
Oh, yes, same thing. Yeah. Lindsay was a high school senior and just graduated and heading to college in Southern California. So at least in this one state in California. So I'm happy about it.
Yeah, I'd be really happy. But you know what the problem is? They come back.
Yeah, I know.
Well, in my case, they never left.
Oh.
I have my mother, my kids, my grandkids. We're one big happy family in one roof.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
So enjoy it now.
I don't know.
Yeah, enjoy your 3 months and then, oh boy.
Yeah. I did not know, Jeff, you were a Gemini boy. I heard.
No, he's a Cancer. He's a Cancer. His birthday is June 27th.
Oh, okay. End of this month. Okay. I thought you were coming up soon, so I just presumed that you were a Gemini. But okay, Cancer. Okay.
I'm right at the switchover, so I have traits of both. All the good traits.
Oh, I see. Yeah. 27 is Cancer. Okay. We have a one in a contract right now in Ohio, 48 units. And I got this one from my friend broker. It's a pocket deal, so it was not on the market, which was good, we thought. And he has a relationship with the other dealer who just, find sellers who do not want to put it on the market. And so they just, he circulated and my friend got it. So it sounded good, but it's pretty much self-managed since the seller got this property in 2006 after, he got this REO from the bank. And the self-managed, as bad as you could imagine. So we received due diligence packages, came in mail. But in the beginning, most of the all the documents are handwritten. And to this date, no tax return and checkbook ledger that Chuck, my partner Chuck, asked for, we haven't received yet. And $100,000 for repair allowance, he just allowed, but allowed us to have. And rent is $100 to $200 lower than the market rent, so it's a big upside. And most of the tenants stay because seller has never raised rent since 2006. No wonder nobody wants to leave. So no vacancy, just like maybe 3%, three vacancies that he uses, one is for office. And as far as I know, that there are four Section 8 tenants. According to the seller, they all behave and it's nice and rent comes in. And so we'll face probably if we get this decided to move on, we'll just face immediately some challenge. One is, okay, since we don't have that enough number to put on, UT, we cannot underwrite. So we are kind of stuck in here, and we can't really tell all the investors about this deal without the UT. How could we, right? So, and...
Rhea, what is the real question here? How do you underwrite it when you don't have all the numbers? Is that the real question?
Yeah, that's number one. If we could, that would be good.
Okay, so what I would do is take the rents that they currently are paying and annualize that out over a year, use a regular 10% vacancy, which is the rule of thumb. Don't put any other income in there and take 50% of that figure for your expenses. And then do a regular mortgage, 20% down, 3% closing, 1% loan points, maybe a 4.8% mortgage on a 30-year and see where your numbers come. And if they come in line, that's probably going to be where you're going to be. Now, the value play is they're $200 below rent. So you have a big upswing. So you're going to do your second set of underwriting with what the normal, and you're going to still factor in a 10% vacancy because you're going to have people leave because they don't want to pay the higher rent.
Exactly.
So you've got to do the numbers systematically, but you've got to do them as if they are right now what the rents are. And 50% of that rent in Ohio is a pretty good calculation. 50% of the gross operating income for expenses is right. And see where it comes in. And also, I would put in a management fee of 6 or 7% because you are going to have a manager. You live in California.
Yes.
Yeah, and nobody's living there in Ohio. So that's what I would do and see where your numbers come. I wouldn't just say we can't do the underwriting because we don't have the numbers, but you know what they're paying for rent, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah, yes.
So, I mean, without even seeing your numbers, I can do the underwriting myself right off the bat.
All right, just send it over to Jeannie. She'll do it for you.
Send it over to me, what they're paying. I'll do it. It takes like 10 minutes that way. Okay?
I'll just send everything over then. It's 22 miles west from Cleveland.
I don't care where it is. I don't care where it is. Okay? I'm just trying to get to a bottom line here because that was a long-winded climb to find the question.
Why, are you hungry, Jeannie? What, do you want to break for lunch?
No, I already ate lunch. I had a salad with hard-boiled eggs today.
I liked the intro. She was giving good stuff, you know. But I'll tell you, right? And if it does look like it's, like, going to be a deal, okay, now you're gonna have to, like, start asking for, like go to your due diligence checklist, okay?
Yeah.
And start banging out a few of those. See if you can get some of the utility bills that they pay, the taxes. You might have to call down the tax assessor's office on the property. Insurance, maybe if you have an insurance broker that's in the area, ask that realtor if he can refer someone or – ask what insurance for that type of building with the carry per unit. So you're going to have to some of these deals that are good deals, you have to actually recreate the financials, and you'll have to do it for your lender, too. So that's what you're going to have to do. But there's only 9 operating expenses, okay? So call up a couple property management companies, 2 or 3 of them, see what a good property manager is going to pay in that area.
Okay. That sounds good. Yeah, that's so helpful. We still have a home, right? We're almost in my partner is getting a little pessimistic about this. So he was trying to, pull the trigger. And then, we just let another one go on the contract just because we didn't get a tax return at the end. So that was New Mexico. So this is second. And, UP9 is coming up. And so I just wanted to report, good news.
It's good to report good news, and it's also good to report that you didn't get taken advantage of.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Yeah. So I think this is a big move for us, and I'll just take one step at a time now, and just like Jeff said, insurance, and we try to recreate this deal. And I'll send you over, Jeannie, please help us.
I mean, I'll take a look at it. It won't take me that long to throw something into a template and see what price I come up with. Don't tell me how much they want. I'll just come up with a price.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds good. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for both. And have a good day. And see you at the UP9.
Okay, Ria.
Right.
Enjoy the sunshine out there.
Yeah. It's not. Actually, I'm just using a heater right now.
We have rain here. Rain and 50 degrees.
Yeah. It's similar.
Yeah.
It's insane. It's June and 52, 48, something like that. I'm quite happy about it. Well, this is our summer. Yes.
Yep. Okay, Ria. Take care.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeannie. Thank you, Jeff. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Okay, up next we have Lynn. Lynn, please go ahead.
Hi, guys. This is Lynn from Baltimore. How are you doing, Jeff? I just had a quick question on different types of financing. I just wanted to get a discussion about what's the difference between private money and institutional lending.
Well, an institutional money is like a family office or a hedge fund or one of those types, and they're more concerned with placing their money and they're not really that concerned about the interest that they're going to get on that money, because if they don't place all of their money, it's going to be reduced the next year by the amount of money they didn't place. So if they have to spend $100,000 and they only spend $60,000, they're only getting $60,000 next year. So they don't really care per se that it's a deal. They more care that they place the money. Whereas an equity partner is a person that's looking to get the most amount of return that they can get on a property. And if somebody's offering an 8 to 10% return on their money and you're only giving 7, they're more apt to go with somebody else because they're more concerned with the annualized rate of return. So they get interest on the property throughout the life, which is probably 3 to 5 years. And then from what you buy it for to what you sell it for, paying back all their money, and it's a 50-50 split with you and them. So their annualized return is going to be in the neighborhood of 20 to 23%. That's what they're concerned with. But an institutional person like a hedge fund, they got to spend the money or they're not going to get it.
Okay, got it. But an institutional, is that more like a, I guess, a debt partner versus an equity partner?
No, they're in as equity, but they're not really concerned. They'll go into a more marginal deal because they got to spend the money. Whereas an equity partner is more picky about where they put their money. So that's why you never want to offer an equity person that's in your network two deals at the same time, because you'll never fill either one. They won't be able to make a decision. But if you offer them one and say, that's all I got right now, they'll fill that one.
Got
it. When you get the next one, you send it, they'll find money if they want to go into both. You don't want to give them a choice because you'll never fill it.
Okay, so you get them to go where you want them to go, basically.
Yes. Yeah, whatever one's closing first is the most urgent.
Okay. Okay, that's all I had. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, up next we have Serge. Serge, please go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I'm back again. So I got a couple of questions, right? Now, what are the advantages or disadvantages of the month-to-month lease?
Oh, no, you don't want month-to-month leases. Month-to-month means they could exit at any time. And if you have a 100-unit building and 25 people are on month-to-month, who's going to pay the bills when these people are gone? Month-to-month is no good.
So it's not a good idea to get like an apartment that have like maybe...
You want them on leases and you want them staggered so that you don't have more than like 2% of the building expiring at the same time, because you don't want to be exposed in any way, because you've still got to pay the mortgage on the property and the payroll and all of the out-of-pocket costs. And if you have, 25, 30 people leaving at the same time because they're on month-to-month, that's really an exposed property for you. You don't want to do that.
So it's not a good idea to get, like, a complex mixed with annual lease and then month-to-month, right? So unless it's, like, 2%
of the... I personally don't like any month-to-month, because if they're in there for a month, you're going to spend money making that ready for the next person to come in. And it's going to cost you $200, $300 to get in there, paint it, clean the carpets, getting it ready for the next person. I mean, it's money you don't have to spend. And somebody that's on a 12-month lease, they may live there for 10 years, and you might never go in and paint their building, their apartment. So it's risky. Very risky.
It is risky, right? So the bank doesn't want to see. If you look at your rent roll, if you are greater than 5% on month to month, the bank's going to say, oh, man, there's too much risk in this deal. I'm going to charge you a higher interest rate. I want you to get those. I want you to get those leased up so you're less than 5% month to month. So the lenders don't like it either. because of the risk. As Jeannie was just saying.
Cool, cool. Now, listen, I have. Okay. Okay, I was looking at a property in New York, right? It's a low income. So what are the advantages of those low income? Because they told me that you get a tax break or whatever it is. So is it something that you guys recommend?
Sir, do you live in New Jersey and you're looking for properties in New York?
Yes.
Why?
Because I guess I should look all over the place, all over USA, right? It's wherever the market is good for me. Because I have properties in Alabama, Georgia, because I have at least 20 of them.
Alabama's good, Georgia's good. What you're looking for is a property in a landlord-friendly state. New York is not one. And neither is New Jersey, nor Boston, nor California. But you want landlord-friendly states so that you have the advantage over the tenants.
Okay.
New York is very expensive. I mean, much more expensive than New Jersey even.
Yeah.
That's not a place I would go look unless I was physically sitting in New York. I wouldn't be looking in New York.
Okay, but even though I do all those, you know, I go over the numbers, everything looks good. I have a 17% cash on cash return and stuff like that. I
and
got a good cap,
income?
Like 9%.
You just said it was a low-income property.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's the government pay or something like that. But the thing is, you know, I mean, when I go over the numbers.
Talking about a Section 8 property?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
So, I mean, Section 8 properties are okay. I like it better when they have to pay X amount of dollars towards their rent. So that they have a little pride of ownership, because when you give something to somebody free, they're apt not to take care of it if they don't have money into the thing. So I don't like 100% Section 8 properties. I like more like 30% Section 8 and 70%, you know, paying tenants.
Yeah. Okay. All right, and I guess I will get the numbers and then get all the information, maybe send them to you, maybe, so we can review them for me, right?
Okay.
Now, I got one more question about equity partner, right? Now, when the time comes for income tax, is equity partner still have some in that money, too?
Equity partners get a K-1, which is basically a 1099 for investment properties. And they get a K-1 that shows how much money they've received as a distribution as well as depreciation on the property. So that is done by a CPA firm. You send over all the financials. You send over the records of what they've earned and how much they have remaining in the property, and the CPA firm takes care of that for you. That's not something you're going to do by yourself.
Okay. Okay, beautiful. All right, get that stuff for today. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, bye-bye.
See you guys Friday. Bye-bye.
Yep.
Okay, up next we have Steve. Steve, please go ahead.
Yes, hi, Jeannie. Jeff, it was very good today. Just a quick question for you. On looking at this is hypothetical though. I see a few times that where they down in Tampa they're offering like 100 unit building, but let's say 30 of them are condos, and they come up with a price. I do the underwriting on the 70 units that are for sale. Really, the other 30, the condo units are really already owned, right? Am I buying just the land, or the? How do you underwrite that sale? Would you? Think?
Well, if they're condos and they're renting them as condos, but you still own the whole complex. But if they're sold to a previous to somebody else, then you need to find that out, because there's a big difference.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, we gotta call a broker find out if which way they're going. If they are they condos included, or are they owned by the individually? Yeah, because if they're owned
individually, they're responsible for everything. That's not part of your buy.
Right. That they're let's say their units are separated, and they're. The only thing I would be responsible for maybe is for the hallways and the ground maintenance or something like that. But they would own their own property because that's legally they that's what they purchased, I think. Okay.
Yeah, to me, that's I don't think you're even responsible for the grounds.
Mm-hmm.
If they own their own condo, they're responsible for all of their own. It's like having a triple net lease, only it's with a condo.
I have to really call up and see whether the condos are owned by the are in the offer, you know, or just rentals, really.
Yeah.
Well, they wouldn't call them condos. I don't know. All right, I got to call. I got to check with the broker.
Yeah, you got to call that one.
And then the other thing, quick, Jeannie and Jeff, is that when you say doing the underwriting, the first time with the underwriting, we base it on actuals, and then we take the value play and do a second set of underwriting. But mm-hmm. my offer is going to really, you know, the obvious question, it's got to be on the actual. And then the second
it's
set.
Based on the actuals, the second set is what you're selling to your investors. You're showing them the original and saying, this is what we're buying, but this is what we're going to make it. So it might take 3 to 4 months, but look at the difference in the cash flow. So if you can bear with me until I get it up, then,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're going to have people flocking to invest in your property because they can see the window of opportunity.
That they got to be pretty much like equity investors and say, listen, hold off, guys. Give me 6 months, a year, you know. Then we'll refinance or cash out, and you know. But you got to give me like 6 months or a year of no payments.
Yeah, when you're doing a syndication, you aren't refinancing and cashing people out. That's not how it works, because they own the lion's share of the property typically. So it's. If it's 100%, you got to take 35% for your side and 65% for their side. I mean, you're promising them a bang at the end. And if you're going to, you know, refinance and try to cash them out, where's their bang?
Yeah, true. That's okay. Yeah, right. You let them share the
you share that, and then you take your money and you plunk it into something else.
Mm-hmm. So on those type of approaches, so you really got to go with the equity guys. Versus the debt. If you get a debt partner, he's going to expect payments every month. You know.
No, he's going to get a payment every year. A debt partner is a yearly payment, and it's an interest only. But they're hard to come by. I mean, if you're looking to raise $1 million, you'd have to get maybe 4 or 5 debt partners in there. Whereas you're going to raise $1 million, you can do it with 10 equity partners, putting up $100,000 each and just syndicate the deal.
Equity partners
are non-voting members. Debt partners, they have no say in. They're just getting an interest payment. You don't even have to report how the property is doing.
Yeah. And they could customarily, generally speaking, they will, like, it's one payment a year. You don't have to do a
That's
monthly
it.
Cash flow.
Nope. In our world, we send out monthly reports. But in your world, you don't have to.
Mm-hmm. It's customary for them to wait a year and then get their money. Your interest. Mm. Yeah, but I think the equity partner is a better sell and where you go. Okay. All right, Jeannie and Jeff, I appreciate your help. It's very, very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, up next we have Ron. Ron, please go ahead.
Yes, this is Ron. This is Ron from Los Angeles area. I have a quick question regarding underwriting. When you're just working through deals, is there a rule of thumb for a market rate spread over 10-year treasuries?
Well, that's out of my league. Jeff, you take that one. I have no idea.
No, I don't know of any rule of thumb on that.
Okay, second question. Why Kansas City is listed as one of the preferred markets, but it says stay on the Kansas City side, not the Missouri side. And I just wondered if you were aware of any reasoning why one might be preferred over the other.
Well, I think St. Louis is coming around, and maybe you're looking at an older list, maybe?
Well, St. Louis is on the list, but Kansas City is listed, but says stay on the Kansas City side, not the Missouri side.
Yeah, I can remember when Dave said that, and I think it's because there were so many opportunities available on the Kansas City side, and there was a lot of crime on the Missouri side at the time.
Gotcha.
I'm pretty sure that's what he was talking about.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the information. Great call.
Hold on a second, Ron. On your first question, right, what we typically do is, like, we'll call up our lender, right? We'll call up Eric Stewart and say, hey, we're looking at this deal. It's in this market. What type of programs do you have out there? What should I carry for interest? Like, what type of term should I carry? So he's the one that basically does all the stuff with the spreads and all that. That's why we don't have a rule of thumb on that. We rely on our mortgage broker, just like to tell us what to carry for in that. And then if we have if the financial look pretty good and stuff like that, we'll shoot it over to him, have him take a look at it too, to see what he sees on the underwriting part of it.
Okay, I appreciate that, and that makes sense. It seems like when we had our training with you there in Long Beach, California. There was a rough rule of thumb just for preliminary underwriting, and then later on, as you try to refine your numbers, you get into specific loan programs.
As soon as you like jump into, because you're gonna be looking at like the last 12 months, like some T and some year to dates and stuff. So you're going to be putting your offer in, but then when you really dive into the financials, that's when you're going to engage your lender too, and like he's going to see what you're carrying for terms and stuff, make sure everything looks good and things like that. That's when he wants to get involved too. It's like right after that, the letter of intent gets it signed, so then you're really fine-pointing everything as you go.
Sounds good.
Yep.
Thank you.
Operator?
Okay, we have no further questions at the moment.
I have a bunch of questions that got sent over, so I'm going to ask. I mean, they're short ones, so let's try to get through them before we end the call. This is from Florence. Can you please explain how a sponsor works again? Does the sponsor put any money in the deal, and what is the sponsor's main responsibility? Some sponsors will put money into the deal. Some will not. They are not required to. Their sole responsibility is to qualify you for the mortgage amount and to have up to 6 months' liquidity in mortgage payments. So if the mortgage on the property is, $100,000, they got to have 6 months' liquidity set aside that they can get at to pony up should something happen with the property. And as far as their net worth, they have to be able to show net worth equal to the whole mortgage amount. Say if the mortgage is on the property is $1.3 million, they got to have net worth equal to that amount. Now, if you have some net worth and they have some net worth, you can co-sponsor the deal, which gives you a better advantage because you're not giving up half of your half to a sponsor because you can qualify for the mortgage. So that was Florence. Now I'm going to do Liz Harris. Can you please answer this question? I have a property that is 46 units in Mobile, Alabama. The lending institution is offering a recourse loan at 5.5% interest rate. I have heard bad things about recourse loans. What is the difference between a recourse and a non-recourse loan? Well, the property in Mobile, Alabama for 46 units is probably recourse because of the purchase price. If the price of the property is under $1 million, it is hard to get a non-recourse loan. Eric Stewart tells me some cases it is possible, but in most cases it is not. The difference between a recourse loan and a non-recourse loan? Recourse means if something happens with the property, they can go after your personal wealth or net worth. If something happens on a non-recourse loan, and you should have an attorney read over this loan because there could be a hidden clause in there, but non-recourse, they try to go after the LLC, but it's a lot more difficult to ever get to you. That's the big difference. Most non-recourse loans are over $1 million. Most recourse loans are under $1 million. But that's not to say that a non-recourse loan, if you miss a mortgage payment, there could be a clause in that loan that says if you fail to make a payment on time, 20% of this loan becomes recourse. So that's why I say have an attorney read over your loan documents, one that you've paid to protect you so that you're not, you know, taken by surprise should something happen. Anything you want to add to that, Jeff?
Nope. You covered everything.
Okay. Here's another one from Frank. Can I use my acquisition fee towards the down payment of a deal? Of course, but not the deal you're working on that you got the acquisition fee on because you don't get that till closing. So you can use the acquisition fee to buy another deal, but you cannot use the acquisition fee on the current deal. Hope that explains that. This is from Kim Smith. Can you help me wrap my head around something? If I found a deal that meets the Holy Trinity number and have an investor, besides finding the deal, what is my role? And will my name be on the deed to the property? Well, you're the managing member of the deal. The investor puts up the money. It's a partnership. I believe if you're only using one investor, it would be a 50-50 partnership. And your role in the deal is to make sure that everybody is doing their job. Your management company's doing their job. Everything's lining up, and the people that work on the property that you're paying are keeping up with the maintenance and the make-ready tickets, et cetera. So you've got a big role in making sure that you're managing that manager to make sure she's doing her job. And I would say if you're going to be the managing member, you want to have a camera on your phone so that you can check that property anytime, day or night. And you also want to make sure that you have a license to the software that they're using on the property so you can see the rents coming in, the money going out, everything. So you're really the managing member and you're the person responsible for delivering information to the investor. Here's one from Fred Trainer. What is the typical percentage that a management company will get on a property? I am looking at a 16 unit, and when I see the P&Ls, the management fee is 5%. I thought anything under 50 units is in the 8 to 10% range. Should I question the expense to make sure it is accurate? Most definitely. I think 5% is pretty low on a 16-unit building. But it could be that this management company is also managing other properties for this seller, and they're rolling it all into one bundle, and they get 5% of each property. So, yes, I would consider questioning what the fee is, and it should be around 10% myself. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Jeff?
Yeah, that seems pretty low. But like, so all you have to do is just call up like 3 or 4 property management companies in that area and find out what they're getting for managing and what's included in that 5%. Hey, you might get 5%, but they're charging all these extra things. So
yep.
It's all about that contract, the manager's contract, and what they're covering.
And then I have another question from Frank P. from Florida. Is now a good time to buy? The reason I am asking is because I heard that the feds are going to increase interest rates in July. If they do that, what does that do for mortgage rates? Well, they might increase the mortgage rate, but they can't go up like, 10%. It could be 0.5%. It could be 0.125%. But what they're going to do is, even though you're getting an increase in your mortgage rate, you're also going to be increasing your rents on the property when you take over. I mean, if you don't buy now, when are you going to buy? You're going to wait till the interest rate goes up to 13% in the next, who knows how long? Because when I first bought my property, that's what the interest rate was. 13%. Within a year, it went down to 10, and within 3 years, we were down to like 4.5. Now I'm down to under 3. So it just depends.
Get a longer term, too. Typically, we're doing 5 to 7 years. Get a 10-year term.
Get a 10-year.
So,
yeah?
Yeah.
And make sure that your loan is assumable. You want to make sure that it's assumable after you buy it, so that somebody can take your assumption, because you'll have a prepayment penalty you may not want to cough up should you find something bigger and better in a different location. Operator, is there any more questions?
There are no further questions at the moment.
Well, I think people are sick of hearing my voice. What do you think, Jeff? I'm sick of hearing my voice.
I am, for sure.
I know you are. I mean, we only sit in the next office from each other, so we get to listen all day long. All right, everybody. Thank you for all of the questions. This was very nice, and I hope we helped each and every one of you. And happy finding properties, and we're here to help you wherever we can. Have a great day.
And to all the vets out there, happy D-Day. My wife's father was at D-Day. He survived. His buddy that went with didn't. But just a salute to all the service people out there. We appreciate you.
Bye-bye, everybody.